You're listening to the Free Oromia podcast, dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. Thanks for tuning in to the Free Oromia podcast. Visit our website at freeoromia.org. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Team Free Oromia, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Team Free Oromia. You can also give us a call on the Free Oromia podcast hotline at 430-755-0727 and leave us a voicemail asking us questions or giving us your feedback. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to the Free Oromia podcast, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. My name is Jal Maro, and I will be your host today or tonight, wherever you are, whenever you're listening, along with my usual co-host, the fabulous, the talented, the brilliant Jal Ango.
Welcome. hello. Thank you for that very generous introduction. I guess we're back at it again. All right. Okay.
I tricked you into thinking the competition was over and then the opportunity to get ahead.
And by the way,
just a fun fact, if you didn't know what Ango means, it means strength or humna. So basically, moral of the story is you don't want to mess with my co-host.
Oh, gosh.
And today we're joined by two amazing guest co-hosts, Jal Waco and Jal Mesa. You would recognize them from episode 19 called The People Are the Sea. Mm-hmm. That was a really good one. So gentlemen, welcome. And we're so happy to have you back on the show today.
Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting us on.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah. Nice. So today we're going to be discussing current events in Oromia with a particular focus on what's been happening in Western Oromia. But before we get into this episode, please follow us on our social media if you're not already. I don't know why you wouldn't be, but this is your this is your reminder to do so. Follow us on Instagram at Team Free Oromia and on Twitter at Team Free Oromia. Also visit our website, freeoromia.org, and take the Free Oromia survey. And also, listeners, you've heard us refer to show notes a lot. So on our website at freeoromia.org/podcast, all of our episodes are available for listening directly from the website, along with the episode descriptions and any show notes. So if we mention a certain video or article, we will link them there for your reference. So check that out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, without further ado, let's get into our topic today. We have a lot to discuss. Let's talk about what's been happening in Western Oromia recently, and honestly, going back to 2018. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about serious human rights abuses, state-sanctioned killings of civilians, mass political imprisonment. You know, we've talked a lot about some of the things that have been happening across Oromia, but we did want to just zoom in a little bit to Western Oromia today. We're also going to talk about, you know, the bigger picture, but since 2018, Walaga, Western Oromia, has been under a command post. There have been internet blackouts, or more generally telecommunications blackouts, and really, really serious human rights abuses that have been happening in the dark. Mm-hmm. On April 27th, the Oromia support group put out a press release titled "Violations in West Oromia: Abuses in 5 districts from October 2018 through April 2021. So we will link that in our show notes for this episode, episode 28, at freeoromia.org/podcast. But I wanted to read a little snippet of this press release to you guys, and just a warning that it does describe violence. Mm-hmm. in talking about Ero who have been targeted and killed since Abby took power, the press release reads in one excerpt, "Now their bodies are found, sometimes partly eaten by hyenas, thrown in forests, fields, rivers, and on streets. Farmers and students are shot in their homes, on farms, and thoroughfares. Prisoners are taken out and summarily executed. Homes of the parents of supporters of Ero are burned down." The press release also says, quote, "Even government employees will not visit relatives in the countryside for fear of being shot as an OLF supporter. Youngsters are shot for having the OLF flag on their phones." This press release also links to a list of names of hundreds of murdered civilians, injured civilians, and imprisoned civilians, as well as some really horrifying photographic evidence of these crimes. So what is your guys' reaction to this? And can you just tell us also some more about what you've been learning is happening?
This press release is based on a report that was delivered to the Oromia support group from individuals in West Wallaga. So these are normal citizens who have been recording the killings, imprisonments, and injuring of people in the area and in the region. So it's just normal civilians who have been acting as citizen journalists, essentially. And they've been recording and keeping track of these things as they have been happening. And they compiled a document detailing all of this information. It dates back to October 2018, as Jalmaro mentioned, and goes up to April 2021. This is just a portion of the human rights violations that have been taking place in the area. Basically, it's information that's been delivered from people on the ground who have been keeping track of what's been happening around them. And this information comes from 5 of the 23 districts in the Wallaga region. So it's just sort of a snapshot of what's been happening in some of the areas in West Wallaga that have been subjected to these types of abuses. So I actually interviewed the chair of the Oromia support group, Dr. Trevor Truman, on Kedlo earlier this week about this report, about this document that they received. And the people who delivered the document to the Oromia support group delivered it with a plea for Oromo people in the diaspora, Oromo people, Oromo communities who have freedom of speech, who are able to share this information freely and openly, to please, please, please use every platform, every resource, every avenue that they have to get this information spread as far and as wide as possible. Because they, the people on the ground, have no means of reporting this information themselves or spreading this information themselves, or for this information to be journalistically recorded. They have no means for this to take place. And just producing this report and handing it to the Oromia support group is so extremely dangerous for them. Every single person who's involved with this has put their lives on the line. And if there is any indication or suspicion about who might be behind this, they will be executed without any hesitation. So it's extremely dangerous for them to even attempt to put this information out there. They have no means of doing so directly themselves because they're under internet and telecommunications blackouts. So this is the only means that they have for this information to be released, for this information to be known. So it's our responsibility to get this out there as much as we can and to make sure that the world knows, the international community knows, what the Ethiopian government is doing, hiding behind these blackouts, hiding behind this information blackout that is currently engulfing Western Oromia.
That was a good point, Jalanko. But I just wanted to clarify the fact that this is nothing new. Just like Jalmaro was saying before, this has been happening for 2 years. It started the same year that Abiy came into power, where there were cases where former known Kero leaders would get arrested and then be killed in custody. And for a long time, the world was more or less, you know, kind of ignoring it, kind of trying to considering it, looking at it as if it's some sort of part of the transition, you know, growing pains kind of thing. But recently, you know, as the war in Tigray has kind of captured international attention, they're looking into the Ethiopian government's practices with a closer eye than they have been for the last 2 years. So hopefully now people will take this more seriously. But like you said, it's been happening for a long time, and there I would say the victims have they number in the hundreds. There's many times we don't even know their names. In many cases, it's not even reported. But it's become kind of a normal thing in many parts of Western Oromia for just dead bodies to be found in surrounding forests, surrounding farmlands, and you know, they're always identified, and it's always somebody who had been previously detained and then taken into custody by either Oromia Special Forces, the National Military, or, you know, the Federal Police. And yeah, so it's clear that it's not just, you know, the one-off soldier or the one-off unit doing it, you know, to be vindictive. You know, it's not like they lost a battle with Wobo, then come back to the city and then try and enact revenge. I would say it's become policy at this point. They specifically target specific people for reasons which are unclear. It's kind of, sometimes it's random. It does seem random because a lot of times the people they kill are not even people who are really into politics. Mm-mm. It's just popular people in the community, or people who just speak out about development, you know, roads. We need to build roads, those kind of things. Even they get targeted, which is really hard to wrap your head around. But yeah, it's a very disturbing practice, and I'm glad that it's getting much more attention now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is policy. They're essentially living on the martial law. Those command posts mean that the people in those areas who are living under that command post are living under military rule. So they are not being governed by civilian rule or civilian laws. And the military has the green light to essentially act with impunity and do anything that they wish to do. Just to sort of give an overview of some of the things that are actually detailed in this report, it lists 127 people who have been killed in the last 2.5 years, and 79 of those deaths were in Gurliso alone. It lists 7 people who were taken from prison and extrajudicially executed. It details that 42 people have been shot and wounded, and that includes a judge. It also includes a 13-year-old and a 3-year-old child. It also talks about properties that have been burned, so 65 properties burned, particularly families of Kero members. And when the report actually was released, another 35 has also been reported on top of those 65. But one of the really terrifying things about this report is the ratio of the number of people who have been detained to the number of people who have been killed. And the OSG has quantified that usually that ratio is somewhere between 100 to 1 to 20 to 1. But in this particular report, in this document, that ratio is actually 2 to 1. So for every 2 people who have been detained, 1 is killed. Wow. Exactly. And that just shows the extent of the lethal force. Exactly. It's mind boggling. Yeah. So that just shows the extent to which lethal force is being used. And it shows how freely the security forces are killing people. Essentially, they're just shooting on sight when they wish to. So it's very, very, very terrifying. And I think it also speaks to the intent of what the security forces are trying to achieve in that region. They're basically just trying to massacre as many people as possible, particularly targeting youth who they believe are members of Kero or they believe could potentially be supporters of Kero. And of course, Wobo.
You know, this becoming like coming to the forefront again just reminded me of the comment that the head of Oromia PP made I forgot what his name was. I forgot what is how to pronounce his name.
Fikadu.
Fikadu, yeah.
Fikadu
Tesema. His comment about draining the sea to get rid of the fish. I definitely think that was not a conjecture or just a random comment. It definitely seems like it's their policy. Mm-hmm. And that policy is also like it's spreading now to other parts of Oromia. I know just today, today and the day before, a father was killed. A father of like 3 or 4 kids was killed. And it's just their way of fighting the opposition or demoralizing the population to make them unable to fight or make them lose morale to fight.
They're also very, especially the Oromia Special Force, Humna Da Oromia, they're an extremely vindictive group. And there's this case that BBC covered of, I believe his name, there was a teacher in Ambo, I believe his name was Ketela Gudata. Mm-hmm. He used to be known political organizer for, during the protest days when Wayane was still in power. Mm-hmm. And just based on that alone, what they did to him is they came, they sent like 20 police officers to go get him. They told his wife, he'll be back. Don't worry. We just need him for, we're just going to ask him a few questions. After that, he disappeared. Later when they searched for him because people are kind of aware of that this happens to the point that even his wife was begging when they took him away, when they're saying it's just for questions, she was saying that take me instead. And I think she knew what was going to happen. And I think even, a lot of times they know exactly what's about to happen to them. Mm-hmm. So they take him. And then later his body is found with his arms tied back. They'd like kind of put him over a rock and then they'd shot him behind him on his back several times. God. And according to a relative that was interviewed by BBC, his back was so littered with gunshot wounds. They believe, they probably playing with his body, using it as a target practice, basically. There's a case where, they torture people before they kill them. I mean, I'm pretty sure you guys have seen that video where there's a crowd and there's four, what looks like Wobo soldiers or like either Kero or Wobo soldiers who had been caught by the Oromia Special Force. And then you can see there's a crowd telling the Oromia Special Force to kill them. Mm. And they do it. It's on camera. They just execute them right there. And whenever you, the Oromia Regional Government is asked about this, they always deny. They always say, we only do it. They don't actually deny. What they say is whoever gets killed, whoever gets targeted, it's because we know that they have ties to criminal elements or, terrorists or something like that. So yeah, it has become policy. It is widespread. And I think what we also need to talk about is the fact that the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission has played a huge role in covering. When I say covering, like keeping this under wraps and not really letting the world know about it. Because I still remember to this day, after personally receiving several reports that this was happening back in 2018, 2019 specifically, actually. And the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission head, Daniel Bakala, was asked by Addis Standard what his views were. Like, are you looking into this? And he said, as far as we know, we haven't seen any reports of mass killing or, government, which what's the word? The extrajudicial killings or summary executions, which was just a bold lie. He certainly would have known because there are several reports already by that time from Amnesty International. And I'm pretty sure at that time there was another OSG report that had come out. And, it's a very painful situation. So there's the case of Mohamed Dek Sisso, who very publicly, in a big way, did his own one-man protest on live TV during the Jimma University graduation ceremony. And he was one of the graduates. He used the opportunity during a musical performance. He got the mic from the singer after the song had ended. And he chanted, free Jawar Mohammed, justice for Ajalu, justice for Oromo politicians.
Let's play a clip of that for our listeners who may not have heard that before. Mm-hmm. Take a listen.
And right after he did that, he was arrested. Not only him, actually. He was arrested. The singer was arrested. They said, you know, you gave him the mic. Therefore, you're also to blame for that. And the Jinmen University public relations head was also arrested. And the rationale behind arresting the PR head was, you're the one who facilitated the live stream. So, you know, you had a hand in publicizing this. So they arrested three of them. The first charges are you have associations with an armed group, a rebel group in this country. When they bring them to court again the next time, they tell them, no, the reason we're actually holding you is because you guys were involved in a grenade attack that killed people in Jinmen. And eventually they release the PR head and the musical performer, the singer. But Mohamed Dixisso, on the day he was supposed to be released, officers, you know, wearing plain clothes, literally take him from the entrance of the jail. As he's walking out of the jail, they stop him, grab him, take him to a car belonging to the Oromia Special Forces, where for a while, they said the vehicle went to Jinmen University, stayed there for a while, and then took him to the Federal Police Southeast Division camp. There's a big camp right outside of Jinmen. And at one point, the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission did send a representative there who did see Mohamed Dixisso and can confirm he was there at one point. But after that, he completely disappeared. And to this day, I think it's been a month now, we have no idea where he is. Mm-hmm. And given the way Oromia Special Police is very vindictive, does not listen to the court system, and when you consider other cases where people have disappeared in their custody, a lot of people, including me, we fear the worst.
Mm-hmm. I think, like, yeah, that story is just really horrifying. And thank you, Jalwako, because you did a segment on his story, on Mohamed Dixisso's story on Kalo Media. So we'll link that in our show notes so our listeners can go check that out for the full scoop. But, you know, when I hear stories like this, what is so bothersome to me is just knowing that this is not an exception. This is the rule. This is the norm right now. There are so many youth in Oromia that have faced the exact same fate. But the crazy thing is, Mohamed Dixisso is the one that was in the public eye. Like, everyone saw that video.
Right.
People knew who he was.
And they were still emboldened, like, bold enough to disappear him, basically.
Kidnap him. And so, knowing that we already have many documented cases, like, for example, in the OSG reports and other, you know, human rights groups reports, that the police continuously disregard the rulings of the courts when they say that, you know, this person can be released, there's no reason to hold them. As soon as they're being released from jail, they take them, you know, somewhere else. Like, we already know that happens.
Right. And the police will literally tell the court that we cannot listen to your orders because we have orders from a superior body. And it's such a weird thing to say because, I mean, that is just not constitutional. I mean, it's not as if the Constitution really matters for the government. They don't really care about what the rules technically are supposed to be. But the fact that they even... So, you know, outright say, no, we cannot listen to the court. Mm-hmm. There's a superior, mm-hmm. we're getting orders from a superior body, is insane. Mm-hmm. It's very worrisome. And it makes you, there's a reason that so much of Oromia is under a command post. There's a reason these command posts have been set up in these specific areas. It is mm-hmm. to supersede, you know, any, you know, the Constitution, any sense of civilian government, any sense that there, you know, the security forces have to be accountable mm-hmm. to
checks and balances,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And we've mm-hmm. seen what that leads to.
One of the things that really surprised me about his case, you guys were mentioning it earlier, was how public it was and the fact that everybody saw him, everybody knew who he was. The video went viral, and they still thought it was okay to arrest them. And it was just so shocking to me because You would think that if somebody was even a pragmatic dictator, if that's a thing, they would think, oh, well, I'm not gonna disappear this guy or arrest him because, you know, everybody's seen him. I want to look like, at least look like I'm not a dictator. But they don't even have the like space for that, just to even do that and think, well, he's public, let's leave him alone. Like it doesn't hurt us for him to say those three words. But they found that so, I guess, either they found that so threatening, just him saying those words, or they just didn't care about how they looked. Like it just didn't matter to them.
I think they're just so emboldened. And it's, I the reason why I even brought up how public it was and the fact that they still did that is because if this is what they're doing to somebody that we all saw, literally on his graduation day, he was dancing on stage. We all watched this video online and we knew his name and we heard the next day that he was arrested. And for them to then take him out and disappear him, knowing that, you know, we were all watching, it just shows that they feel they're untouchable. And it also shows that if this is what they're doing to someone that's, you know, relatively in the public eye, at least for people who are paying attention and watching, I'm not going to say that everyone knows. So I'm sure like some of our listeners may not have known about his story, but, you know, a lot of people knew who he was. That just shows you what they would do when no one is watching, which given the telecommunications blackouts, that's the case for the vast majority of what they are doing. On a previous episode, Jalango interviewed Dr. Trevor of the Oromia Support Group, and he said himself that in all likelihood, we only know a very small percentage of the crimes that have been committed. And it's possible that the crimes reported, for example, in the OSG reports could be as low as 5% of what's really happening.
Yeah,
I really tried to understand the rationale behind arresting him. It really speaks. I mean, like, I mean, before I was talking about how vindictive the Oromia Special Force officers can be. But in this specific case, I really, really try and understand, was what he did so unacceptable to them, so embarrassing to them, that they're going to go out of their way to literally make him disappear off the face of the planet?
Do you know what I think it is? I really get the sense, and, you know, from a lot of how the Ethiopian state and security forces are responding to any form of dissent, is that they just cannot stand what in their mind is this insubordination of the Oromo people. How dare the Oromo people speak up for themselves? How dare they speak out against their abuse? How dare they stand up for their rights? Like, it's, I think it comes from...
Especially because they didn't have the guts to do so. Because they're sellouts. Like, imagine the psychology of a sellout, seeing someone who, knowing that their life is on the line, does what's right anyway. That probably makes them sick inside.
It probably does. It probably really does. And, you know, it's just this sense of the Ethiopian state considering Oromo people to be so lowly and so worthless that they just cannot in any way, shape or form tolerate that Oromo people would speak out against the injustices that are being committed against them. Like, that's the sense that I get from, you know, even how state media report on incidences that happen in Ethiopia, the way they generally speak about Oromo people, it's very much with this condescending tone that is just so indicative of this perception of Oromo people as being less than and as being unworthy of any kind of human consideration.
And as all this is happening, we're expected to be awaiting elections on June 5th, coming very soon. And it's very clear that the whole election is a farce. The world knows it. The EU knows it. UN knows it. The Ethiopian people know it. Oromos know it. It's a farce generally, right? But why is Abiy so adamant that we have to have these elections? No postponement, even though they did that under the most with the most dubious justification, that, like what, like a year ago, where they used the COVID pandemic as justification to postpone it, and then came up with some, they had these conferences where these lawyers would come in and then just kind of make a mockery out of the Constitution, just pull out different, like a line from one place and a line from another to put together like a constitutional justification for extending Abiy's term. He went through all of that time. Now, when there's so much more going on in the country, the situation is so much worse. There is essentially no opposition to PP in Oromia. You cannot have elections in Tigray. You cannot have elections in Western Oromia. There's parts of the southern region where you cannot have election. You cannot have polling stations. But he's adamant that we have to have it on June 5th. And the reason behind that is, one, he kind of wants to get it over with. The whole world has been looking at Ethiopia, waiting. This is the great transition. And it's all leading up to the elections, right? The whole point is we're going to get elections. And then after that, the transition is over. So the world will stop looking as stringently at Ethiopia, China. You know, they've been waiting for the Ethiopian story to come to an end, if you guys get what I mean. And after that, after he's gotten his legitimacy through these sham elections, that is when I believe all these crackdowns, all that we have seen now, are going to be increasing in intensity. They're going to get much, much worse than what we're seeing so far. Because he's doing all this while the world's eyes are looking at the country. And yeah, that's one thing that really worries me. It's if these elections are allowed to happen, and then the world kind of, you know, stops paying attention, we might be seeing what, you know, these disappearances in much, much higher numbers. There's no reason for them to keep, you know, they've already considered these. What did Abiy say? Abiy was talking about how Oromia does not need all these different voices talking about Oromo nationalism. He said Oromo nationalism kept Oromos down. So in his mind, he has to wipe out Oromo nationalists. And he's not above just killing them while they're in prisons. And he's already imprisoned all of them. So I don't know. For me, these elections can be a big worry.
So, you know, we've been discussing human rights abuses in Western Oromia specifically. Of course, we know that human rights abuses are happening in all parts of Oromia. There is a war on Oromia as a whole, on the Oromo people as a whole. And that's not to take away from that, but why do you think, you know, in particular, again, going back to 2018, just shortly after Abiy took power, why do you think there has been such a crackdown in Western Oromia specifically?
One answer is that is where one of two largest Oromo Liberation Army sectors are. So they have the southern sector, which is in Gudji and Borana, and then their western zone, which is mainly based in West Wollaga, but have operations in East Wollaga, Jimma, Ilu, and that general region. So that's one reason. The other reason I would say is I don't think Western Oromia is unique in this, but it is also a place which has historically just have given a lot of support to OLF. So it was generally kind of expected that people will stand no chance there. Mm-hmm. And in the same can be said of Borana, the same can be said of Gudji. Those have been historically areas where for a long time OLA was basically centered there. For a long time, that's where most of OLA was operating. So they have a culture of kind of supporting OLF. So that's why I believe the crackdowns have been, you know, so intense in these specific places.
Mm-hmm. And also, something that happened, particularly in West Wollaga, is that a lot of, and, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Gedro have been particularly targeted in that area. A lot of Gedro members were elected to local administrative posts after the fall of the TPLF regime. So there was this whole movement, you know, called Team Lemma, which helped propel Abiy to power. And a lot of Gedro youth rallied behind that Team Lemma movement, you know, particularly in West Wollaga. And then many of those Gedros, like I say, were elected to official posts in the region. So, you know, they also had some level of local administrative power. in that area. And I think that Abiy's regime considered that a very large threat to their power. So I think that played a role in it as well, that they wanted to kind of undo. I mean, and this was all part of Abiy coming to power. This is literally what propelled him to power. These youth were the ones who propelled him to power. And now he's turning against them and trying to eliminate them from the little bit of control that they managed to get in their own local areas to prevent them from interfering with his terrorism against innocent civilians in their districts.
Yeah, it's very true. Good points.
I also think that I agree with the points you guys made. I think that one of the, I agree, especially with what Waka was saying about how the Western Oromia is one of these stronger Oromo Liberation Army fronts. And I think with the government trying to fight OLA, it seems like they've been unable to, blow any kind of decisive defeat against them. They've repeatedly promised that they're going to destroy them in, you know, just 1 week or just 2 weeks. Just give us 2 weeks. But they've been unable, and instead the army has grown exponentially within the last couple of years. And so I think with OLA being a guerrilla army and fighting with guerrilla tactics, I think a lot of these killings and human rights violations follow defeats on the government side and militarily, where, you know, they're frustrated. And their reaction to those defeats is to take it out on the civilians. But as history tells us, and as we know, that just fuels the fire. Just it, you know, a government, when they're fighting an insurgency or a rebel group, a good government, if they want to beat this rebel group or insurgency, they are supposed to legitimize themselves and, you know, offer services to the people, and, you know, come to the people as a legitimate force. But instead, what they've done is the exact opposite of that, which has historically been not good. And that's to take it out on the people and try to drain the ocean just to kill the fish.
You're absolutely right, John Mesa. And you brought up the, you know, the people are the sea earlier. And actually, that was the episode that you and Jawako joined us for last time. So in case our listeners kind of forgot about that, we'll just insert a real quick snippet from that episode here now.
TPLF was, they based their guerrilla structures based on Mao's teaching, Chairman Mao of China. And he had said something along the lines of, the guerrilla must move amongst the people as the fish swims in the sea. And so I guess I was about, kind of was retorting to that and saying, so to kill the fish, we must drain the ocean. And so we're seeing a repeat of that today. And we're like on the Oromia State Council, the head of the Oromia Prosperity Party coming out and saying those words.
And then actually, it was on Guya Gotata, right, that Jal Maro made that speech,
yeah,
where he pretty much directly addressed
that statement, yeah,
Fikaru Tesama's comments there. Mm-hmm. Kind of, yeah, pretty much reiterating the idea that the people are the sea and the fish and the sea are one, and there's no way to break that. So take a listen to that. Urtumichis galanichis harra walkes. Urtumichis gargarimba galana marin infita infed umani oromo galan galanichakesambo. Honestly, I can't get enough of that. So I think since we haven't found a way to insert that into an episode yet, I hope you enjoyed that, listeners. But let's shift gears a little bit and discuss the government's, the Ethiopian government's recent declaration of TPLF and Shene as terrorist organizations. So first, a little bit of backstory. On April 27th, the Oromo Liberation Army High Command released a statement titled "OLA's Propositions for Resolving the Political and Economic Instability in Ethiopia," in which they outlined an 8-point plan to resolve those issues. In summary, this included cessation of hostilities, withdrawal of foreign troops, release of all political prisoners, postponement of the sham elections that are planned for June, independent investigations, transnational conference to form a transitional government, and other things as well. Just 3 days later, on May 1st, the Prime Minister's office issued a press release informing the public that the TPLF and, quote, Shene have been categorized as terrorist organizations. So before we get into your responses to this declaration and your reflections on it, I first just want to talk about the elephant in the room. So again, the literal title of this press release from the Prime Minister's office was categorizing the, quote, Tigray People's Liberation Front, parentheses TPLF, end quote, and, quote, Shene, end quote, as terrorist organizations. So, you know, from people that have seen and read this press release, this has been widely interpreted to mean TPLF and OLA, the Oromo Liberation Army. But that's not what was stated. So, you guys, what is Shene? Spill the tea for our listeners. What is Shene, and why does the Ethiopian government never call OLA by name and never call OLF by its registered name, because it's a legally registered political party?
So there's a lot of backstory to Shene, the name Shene, that we can get into, but with the recent context, it's just a label used by the government as a catch-all label for any opposition it has in Oromia. So it doesn't matter if you're associated with Oromo Liberation Army, with the Oromo Liberation Front, with the Oromo Federalist Congress. If you're against UBI, if you do not stand with UBI, they can use that label on you, and they can basically do what they want. And they have kind of been feeding on state media and mainly, you know, mainstream Amharic media that's, you know, broadcast in Amharic. They've been building this bogeyman, Shene, this kind of force that's working with Egypt, working with TPLF, you know, anything and everything under the sun that goes wrong in Ethiopia, it's always Shene. If it's not TPLF, it's going to be Shene. And sometimes, apparently, they have a partnership. I believe it was Jawar Mohammed who said, I forgot the specific, but it's label, defame, destroy, something like that. Designate, defame, destroy. That's what the government is trying to do with the name Shene. They use it to legitimize the mass arrest of thousands of youth activists, the mass arrest of thousands of opposition party members, dozens of opposition party leaders that are imprisoned. It's all under this guise of, you work with Shene, you're Shene, you fund Shene. And now this new, I mean, I don't think anything on the ground will change with this new designation of Shene as a terrorist group. But I think it'll help them, well, saying, you know, Shene, whatever it is, whatever they're specifically referring to, saying that it's a terrorist group, I think it's a more for diplomacy. So in future dealings with, for example, Kenya, when it comes to border issues, they're going to be pushing for Kenya to also designate whatever, you know, Shene, and I'm using air quotes here, as a terrorist group as well. And or Somalia, you know, you also have to do it just to be able to kind of encircle specifically the Oromo Liberation Army, technically.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, I would love to hear, you know, more of your thoughts, Jalango and Jalmesa, about just generally what you think about this declaration. But Jalwako, to kind of go back to something you were saying, in terms of the diplomacy factor, how do you think it serves the regime to, you know, refer to a terrorist group by a name that doesn't correspond to any, like, actually existing body or entity?
I mean, the more unclear it is what Shani is, the wider, you know, the more kinds of people they can apply it to. If it's a very specific, if they said Oromo Liberation Army, then everybody would know exactly what they're talking about. And so if it's a, if they're arresting, for example, a Kafao member, he's saying that you're Shani or you're part of Oromo Liberation Army, and then the person is a known figure in the city, he's a known organizer or that kind of thing. It just shows to be a bigger farce than if they just say Shani, because like I said, it's just a catch-all phrase, term for any opposition. But another reason they don't want to use the word Warana Obrisuma Oromo or Oromo Liberation Army is just because of the weight that holds amongst Oromos. Oromos, you know, there's a lot of people's favorite songs are about OLA and Wobo, and a lot of people have a strong emotional attachment to that term. Mm-hmm. So if they're saying we're putting an Oromo Liberation Army under the, we're giving it a, you know, we're categorizing it as a terrorist group, it just looks bad. It just looks bad for PP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I agree. I think, outright calling OLA or the OLF terrorist organizations, I think they recognize that that will be interpreted by anyone and everyone as a declaration of war against the Oromo people officially. Like, you know, they can't hide behind excuses or hide behind, you know, other ways that they try to disguise that. That is essentially what they're doing anyway. But I think that that just brings it out into the open that, okay, you're just attacking anything and everything that has to do with being Oromo or that is in defense or in representation of the Oromo nation, you know, that it just becomes immediately obvious and evident if they do that. But also this Shane term has been used in connection with OLF. So the expression OLF Shane have been broadly used as well. So there is that sort of loose, or not even particularly loose, but I guess the sort of informal connection, because they haven't formally said it in this press release, but there is that sort of informal connection with OLF particularly. I think we've all heard on several occasions the term OLF Shane used on, you know, Ethiopian state media and by Ethiopian politicians to describe this, you know, phantom entity that they've invented.
Yeah, I mean, what I have seen from the regime, they like to say Oneg Shane, which Oneg is the Amharic acronym for OLF or Abao. Mm-hmm. And typically, when they say Oneg Shane, they're actually referring to Ola or Wabo. Mm-hmm. And I get the sense that they kind of use that term to indicate, you know, because they also like to use the framing. They just refer to OLA or Wabo as a breakaway faction of OLF.
If you look at what the Oromia PP cadres on social media, the way they use the word Shane, they don't use it in the sense that specifically for Oromo Liberation Army. They use it for OFC. They use it for OLF. They use it for OLA. They use it for anybody who, like I said before, any opposition to PP in Oromia is going to be labeled Shani. And I also wanted to talk about the other reason. Before I was talking about how it would look like for Oromos if they put Oromo Liberation Army under the terrorist categorization. But even for the international community, seeing Abiy, who, you know, presents himself as this Oromo leader, the first so-called Oromo prime minister of Ethiopia, if he's there and designating the Oromo Liberation Army as a terrorist group, it looks bad on him. It raises questions. So Oromos don't support this guy, just for you know, the casual observer.
No one supports this guy.
So there's also that. There's that he's very aware of that.
You know, I'm That's starting so true. To think that the only reason he didn't say OLF or OLA is because he put, now his enemies TPLF, and TPLF put OLF on the terrorist list. So he just didn't want to do the same thing that they did.
I found it interesting the way they spelled
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Literally, I was thinking
just,
that
oh,
as
I
well.
Oh, I can't do that because that will mess
because
up my
TPLF
narrative.
Because TPLF did
so
it.
I'm just gonna...
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Literally. I mean,
like,
because...
How ironic would that be?
No, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. That's the thing. I mean, Jalwako, I agree with you 100%. Just the optics of putting a group with the term Oromo in it on a terrorist list would be detrimental to Abiy, not just externally, but also internally, because that kind of officializes this idea of demonizing Oromo people or anything that is associated with Oromo people in Ethiopia. And he doesn't want to do that. And also, like you said, Jalmaro, 100%, he doesn't want to copy the TPLF, so to speak, because the TPLF, they just came out and put OLF on the terrorist list. They said OLF is a terrorist group. Done. For this administration to do the same thing, it would look really hypocritical, and it would distinguish mm-hmm. them not at all from the previous regime. I mean, we all already know how PP is basically just a reincarnation of the TPLF, EPRDF regime, OPDO, etc. These guys just came together and formed PP and just threw TPLF out of the equation. We all know that, but they don't want to make that as obvious as putting OLF on a terrorist list in exactly the same way that the previous regime did. And, you know, a large part of the PP support is amongst the Oromo collaborator class. And the Oromo collaborator class is extremely opposed to the TPLF. And, you know, they say, okay, the TPLF is responsible for all of the harm and all of the demise that has taken place in Ethiopia. And they blame the TPLF even now for what they themselves are doing and for what PP are doing. And for this regime to then turn around and do exactly the same thing as the previous regime has done, it just wouldn't align with serving the interests of trying to keep this Oromo collaborator class on board. But at the end of the day, we know what they mean by Shane. By Shane, they mean Ola, they mean OLF. And like you said as well, Jalwako is a catch-all for any other Oromo opposition that they deem to be a threat.
Another perspective I think that we can look at this from is that it shows that the government is doubling down on their war and their crackdown in Oromia and Tigray. You know, even just a couple of days before, the Oromo Liberation Army, as you guys talked about earlier, released a statement. And there they talked about, you know, having talks like, you know, everybody coming to the table and then ending the war. But this, you know, this statement, what it shows is the government is not at all interested in having any talks or any kind of negotiations with any groups within the country that have legitimate claims, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what really scared me, I guess, after reading this, was just the idea that even with considering how much violence has already happened, this government is still like, they have just begun, you know, they're just beginning. They're not anywhere near done with their, you know, with their wars.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that this terrorism designation came right after the Oromo Liberation Army put out a statement calling, you know, for a unconditional and immediate ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And the response by Abiy is to technically label them as terrorists. And I mean, it just shows that he's not interested in anything. He's not interested in deviating from his original plan at all. And his original plan is just, you know, position himself as the only power in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's working towards. And I think he's decided it's either that or he's going to go by way of Tewodros or by way of Mengistu, which is either like he's going to do a last stand in Finfine or he's going to leave the country when, you know, it comes down to actually having to try and forcefully remove him from office, since he's not allowing for democracy to actually take hold in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other thoughts on just general responses to what this declaration means?
I don't think it's going to change anything when it comes to their conduct and the measures they've been taking. It's not like they're going to, because they're now there's they're officially, I mean, for the past year, PP cadres were on Facebook already calling them terrorists. So it's not going to change anything on the ground. Perhaps maybe just when they're talking about, like, if a news report talks about the Oromo Liberation Army, they're going to be like, the Oromo Liberation Army, called Shane by the government, and which has been designated a terrorist group by the Ethiopian government. That label can maybe have some effect, maybe for the casual observer trying to just reading it through, seeing that might, you know, make them think differently about the Oromo Liberation Army. But apart from that, I don't think it's going to change anything on the ground. It's not going to mean that they're going to suddenly put more resources into fighting OLA than they already have been.
Mm-hmm. I think there's certainly a risk that it will lead to a lot more civilian deaths, because now they have this excuse as a cover-up. They can just say, well, they were part of the Shane terrorist organization. So I do worry that it will allow for even more impunity in regards to the death of civilians, in regards to extrajudicially executing civilians and targeting civilians. But I think there is also a significance behind this declaration being made, in that there are reports of the PP regime having lost control of more than 50% of Oromia's administration. So I think there's some desperation. Yeah, I think there's some desperation behind this declaration as well, seeing that they're losing control over Oromia and trying by any means to scratch that control back, and likely using this declaration now as an excuse to crack down on civilians even more.
Yeah, and for those who may not be aware of the context, Ethiopia has a very notorious anti-terrorism proclamation. And so, you know, going back to your point, Jalango, about increasing their impunity, the ATP, the anti-terror proclamation, has been used by the previous regime since its creation to crack down on dissent. And it's been a cover for that. Human rights groups, like Human Rights Watch, have reported on this. There's a lot of documentation of how that's been used. Initially, when Abiy took power, he was praised for all of these, quote, reforms and the political reforms that he was making, but the ATP still stayed. Last year, they actually conveniently revised it, but there were no fundamental changes. It's pretty much the same thing. You know, they did it under the guise of, oh, there's, you know, all these loopholes that have made it, able to be twisted and used as a tool against the people. Mm. And so they tried to say that, oh, we're revising it because this is part of our reform. Mm. But it's really essentially the same. There are very minor changes, like some of the terminology that, you know, supposedly made it clearer, but ultimately it's the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And we can see that that's exactly what they're going to be doing. The same thing that was done before. Mm-hmm. Using that as a cover, just putting everything under the umbrella of terrorism. Mm-hmm. I wanted to also point out some of the phrasing at the end of this statement. Again, I'm talking now about the press release that the Prime Minister's office issued on May 1st. At the end of the statement, it reads, "This decision will become applicable to organizations and individuals who collaborate, have links with, or relate to the ideas and actions of the designated terrorist organizations."
So like thought crimes.
Relate to the ideas. Yeah. Does this not give you 1984 George Orwell thought police vibes?
Yeah. I mean, you can in Ethiopia, but you shouldn't be prosecuted just because of what you're thinking. And then how can you prove somebody relates to their ideas?
Mm-hmm. That is directly talking about Oromo nationalism.
Yeah, because what are the ideas if they're not specific?
The ideas are Oromo nationalism.
Right. Literally. No, but I'm saying in their rationale, right? They're not saying what Shani is. they're not bringing up where's the Shani Manifesto so that people can know not to relate to those ideas. They're being, again, very yeah. clearly vague.
We'll tell you when you've related to the ideas.
Right.
We determine that. It's so barbaric.
Do you guys think that this is just like kind of like a official declaration of war against Oromos and Oromo nationalism? Even though the war has been going on for a long time, maybe this can be viewed as like a kind of
first time declaration. It's a declaration that there will never be a peaceful negotiation. Mm-hmm. I think I should have said it before. That's actually the most significant part of this move. Mm-hmm. It signifies that Abiy has no interest in ever engaging in talks. Mm-hmm. You know, he's decided it's either he has to wipe out these people or it's just not going to work out for him. So yeah, so we're not going to see any peaceful resolution. And it does mean that we're in it for the long haul. There is not going to be some mediated resolution here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what a convenient way to wipe out your most potent opposition, right? Just label them terrorists. Right. And if they're terrorists, they can't come to the negotiation table. They're terrorists. Hello.
Right.
So
we don't negotiate with terrorists.
We don't. Yeah, exactly. We don't negotiate.
Yeah, maybe now he'll say, oh, yeah, we can have a dialogue. Right. Like, oh, after we jail all the opposition, now we can have an election. After I label all groups terrorists that don't agree with me, now we can have a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say this about the election too. Of course, COVID was the rationale behind postponing it the first time. COVID is hitting Ethiopia harder than ever right now. Harder than ever. There's a new strain that's in the country, killing people at much higher rates than before. Mm. And the strain that actually has hit Ethiopia, it's not like the old strain where young people generally were okay. No, this is killing people, young, old, in between. It's killing a lot of people back home. And it's insane the fact that they're still willing to go ahead with the election. There's very little. I don't want to say there's a sophisticated form of dictatorship, but Abiy and his people, his whole clique, and his cronies, they're so... explicitly unsophisticated in the way they cover for themselves that sometimes it's amusing, but yeah.
Belligerent, blubbering fools and idiots trying to pose as some form of reasonable leadership.
Right. And you guys saw I was going to bring it up before. If you looked at the paper, it's specifically titled the name for Shane that they used. They did like the Amharic, when they translated directly from Amharic, they've been saying Oneg Shene, and then they do S-H-E-N-E. And for me, that it just tells me a lot about who was behind, putting that document together.
Okay. So, we've talked a little bit about what we see as far as the implications of this declaration, this categorization. Sounds like ultimately the state violence we expect to continue, very sadly, but that this will likely give them more of a cover for what they're doing. But going back to Ola itself, do you guys have any updates as far as how Ola is doing, how they're progressing in terms of their defense of Oromia and Oromo civilians against the real terrorism, which is Ethiopian state terrorism?
I know that they started operations in RC. They had units there before, but now they're actually launching like large scale operations there. And before now, we knew that they got into West Shoa. I think now they're also operating in East Shoa. And I think they're preparing to have a larger presence in Hararghe as well. So it does seem like they're getting stronger every day because, a lot of people are joining them. As they're losing faith in the Abiy regime, a lot of youth are taking the extra step to join, get training, and then fight for Oromia.
Yeah. I've actually heard some really interesting news today. directly from the ground concerning Wobo and their expansion. In Bali specifically, I know of a town there that where apparently a lot of the youth had run into the forest after the protests following the death of Ajalu, because all of the youth were being targeted for arrest, and unfortunately hundreds of them were captured and still remain in jail. But there was a large number of them that were able to get away and go into the forest. And this was last year, I think it was in June or July. And I recently found out that they had made their way to Western Oromia in order to receive training from OLA. And they just recently came back all equipped and trained, and apparently they've already started fighting. So I think what this was like information that I was like, you know, personally able to verify, and it was crazy to hear that because it just shows how much OLA has grown and also like how organized they are these days. I think people kind of underestimate how much power they have, and it's kind of hard to tell. But it's very clear that they are very well organized, very well funded, and they are very also determined. And considering if that's happening, then I'm sure that is happening in other regions all across Oromia. And it's not really a matter of will OLA be active in these regions, but just when. And then also, as Waka mentioned, we know they're in Shawa. They've had multiple battles within 100 miles from Finfine. I think that it's just also there just a matter of time. If OLA decides one day, they might be able to cut off Finfine. And I think that would be a huge blow to the regime. So I think overall, looking at how they're doing, I think the government is quickly starting to see that the Oromo Liberation Army is posing more of a threat to the regime and actually being able to overthrow it by force than TPLF is. And I think what we're going to see soon is more military attention being focused on Oromia, just because it's more unlikely that the TPLF would be able to really threaten the regime and their seat in power, as compared to OLA, which is, you know, outside of Finfine. And then on top of that, they've been active in many new regions and continue to grow.
And a couple notes on that. More or less, Abiy has given up on his chances of pacifying Tigray. He's kind of just left it to the Eritreans. Just this month, the Eritreans launched for the first time huge offensives in central Tigray. Offensives that were before previously undertaken by ENDF, what was left of ENDF. Mm-hmm. And it's come to the point where they've kind of, Abiy has kind of understood, like, he cannot control the Eritreans. He cannot tell them to stop. It's just better for him to focus on the more immediate, closer threat, which is the Oromo Liberation Army. That's why we've seen reports of, you know, new deployments into the west, new deployments into the south, and also at least two Eritrean brigades have come into Oromia. One was sent to the south, one was sent to the west. They're reportedly operating around Kidami and Dambidolo. So the government is taking them as a much bigger threat than they previously did. Even though they were previously fighting them, they kept them in the peripheries. But inch by inch, they got closer. Now they're, you know, they're very close to Finfine. That's where their operational reach has gone to. And I'm always impressed by how mobile they are. They're able to move very large distances pretty quickly. And from what I've heard, they actually, like, the trainers and some of the officers, they move around a lot. So if they're in the western zone, sometimes they go to the south. The south ones sometimes come to the west. So there's that kind of connection between them.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jal Mesa, you know, what you were saying earlier about the expansion of Ola's operations is really interesting. And like I mentioned earlier, it's reported that the current regime has lost control of over 50% of Oromia's administration. That is extremely significant. And that is due to Ola. Much of that is due to the operations of Ola. So that's something to really consider. That means that the majority of the Oromia region is not under the control of the Ethiopian government. It's that serious. And that means that we as Oromo people, organizing ourselves right now is more crucial than ever. Like, this is the time when we need to be kicking things up into high gear. It's getting really, really serious.
Yeah, a lot of the areas that the government does not have control of are the rural parts of Oromia. And a lot of these areas, it's like the government is only able to keep control of the most major population centers. But then, you know, where 80% of the Oromo population lives, which is in the rural side of the country. And a lot of these places, Wobo has, you know, full control. And these areas are now under civilian governance, not by the, you know, federal government or any outsiders. Another interesting thing about that, and it just, I think, also speaks to the reach of Ole now, is that even I know of somebody that's a very old person that lives somewhere in Oromia on the most rural side of Oromia, where, you know, the internet barely works, and somehow this person knows about Jaramillo, and not only knows about Jaramillo, says, oh yeah, Jaramillo is my hope, or, you know, and this is somebody that lives on the other side of Oromia from where Jaramillo is. And
wow,
when I learned about this, it was just like, wow, like, you know, that's how far what they're doing has spread to where people are saying, people that who are, you expect to not be connected to any of this, are saying, that's my hero, or that's the person that's going to save us. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, yeah, so as you all have mentioned, the government does appear to be losing control, already has lost control over some areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally responded to Ole's moves, Ole's blitzkrieg, as René Lefort described it, with the implementation of command posts. So there have been command posts in Western Oromia and Southern Oromia for a long time already.
Mm-hmm.
But the jurisdiction of these command posts are, you know, slowly expanding. Mm-hmm. As the OLA's operations get more significant in the central areas and in Arsi now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, you all have given me, and I'm sure all our listeners, a lot to think about. I think we could probably go on this topic for hours. But I do want to, before we wrap up, give our listeners some information about what they can actually do to help. There is a letter writing campaign being coordinated by the Oromia Human Rights Group, which is a consortium of different Oromo human rights organizations. They have drafted a template letter that you can send to your political representatives. The letter calls for a postponement of the upcoming June 5th elections, the release of all political prisoners, and support for an inclusive dialogue with the assistance of international partners. We will have this linked in our show notes, so go check it out and send the letter. So go to freeoromia.org/podcast under episode 28. We will have the letter linked there, as well as the other resources that we've referenced throughout this episode. And of course, support Wobo.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else that you all want to add?
I believe there's a GoFundMe being set up to help people in conflict-affected areas, specifically in Western Oromia and Southern Oromia. It's not out yet, but just to keep just to let people know to keep an eye out.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah,
we will definitely share that on our social media when that comes out, and if we can also add that to our show notes as well.
And there's also the Oromia Support Fund, which has been going for a few months now, and that's kind of an overarching fund to address all of the issues and difficulties that Oromo civilians are facing because of the terrorism of the Ethiopian state. So, you know, do donate to that fund consistently. I think we'll add that into our show notes as well. Right, Maro?
Yes.
Yeah.
Listeners, as always, we want to hear from you. Call us, leave us a message. Tell us what you thought about our conversation today. Our hotline is +1 430 755 0727. Leave us a voicemail. Let us know. Mm-hmm. Jalwako, Jalmesa, thank you so much for joining us. I genuinely meant it when I said that I think we could go on for hours, but we'll have to leave it there for now.
Truth. Yeah. Yeah,
thank you
on
for
this
having
occasion.
Us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a pleasure as always.
Yes, I'm sure we'll have you back soon, mm-hmm. per our listeners' demands.
Yes, indeed.
All right, everyone, take care. We'll see you next week. Bye.
All right. Bye, everyone. Naimi makaxe na ya tchese se fundo fabonto nagama tchese halkanu galgala najala tchese tanjolu masan nadaba tchese orumi
nagnam bafenne mama nagna bafet aya yoti ko di tsu barbad demo enne walal ke sawo bo mal kajele alela
alela kajele
enne tesa ke sawo bo mal kajele
alela alela
Jige sawo bo mal kajele
alela alela kajele
enne zone le tawo bo mal kajele
alela alela